Got it.
Yeah. Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
Dave.
Dave's not what? Here.
Dave.
What?
It's time to start the show.
That's right. It's 4 o'clock. Time now for Out of the Box. And you're listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea Kauai Community Radio. Mahalo to Richard for a great melodic flow show.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Richard. That was awesome. Way to fill in there. That was great.
What did we go out with there? Do you know?
That was Orlando Julius.
Psychedelic woman. That was tasty. Okay.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, volunteers, board, or underwriters.
That's right. Okay, well, again, this is Out of the Box. I'm your host, Dave Giroux. I'm here with co-host...
Should I say my name?
Yeah, you say your name.
Jonathan J.
Jonathan J. And we've got a studio full of people here today.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
We're here with Nick Schweitzer and his group of, or troop of, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts. Tell us who you are.
Cub Pack 826?
Yeah, Pack 826 in Honolulu. We're new Pack. Just got a bunch of Tiger Scouts, all the six-year-old boys here, really excited. It's just awesome to be here, just showing the boys how awesome, the great things we have here in Honolulu and the island. So it's a fantastic to be here. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You guys got cool shirts. Yeah, I like those.
Where's ours, by the way?
Yeah, did you bring shirts for us?
Do your best. It wouldn't fit.
Maybe next time.
I like a size medium, please.
Okay. Well, we got a great show for you today. We have a special guest in the studio, Graham Nash. He will be joining us for the two-hour show, and we'll be talking a little bit about him and what he is doing around the world. Graham, check your microphone out there.
Yes, indeed.
It's working great. Okay, let's start the show then. Well, let's start off with you, Graham. Then where are we going to go with this anyway? One of the things I looked at your bio and everything. You started out with the Hollies 50 years ago, and one thing I was really shocked to hear: the Hollies had more number one hits than the Beatles. Is that true? That's what Wikipedia said.
Wikipedia, you know, you got to consider your source.
Yeah, right.
You do have to consider your source. We did have a lot of hits. We were very lucky, you know, because we were really just five kids from Manchester that were trying to escape from Manchester because you were supposed to do what your dad did. You're supposed to do what your granddad did.
Like work in the factory.
Oh, yeah. If it, you know, go down in the mine, you know, work at the mill. If it's good enough for your granddad, then it's good enough for you, son, and get on with it. My mother and father never allowed me to fall for that.
Smart and loving.
And loving, yeah.
So Holly's very successful, had a lot of great tunes. I remember them all. When I was a kid, Bust Up, He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, Look Through Any... What's that, Look Through Any Window? Did you write that one about voyeurism? What was that all about?
Yeah. I'll tell you what happened.
What do you see?
We had a manager called Michael Cohen, and he owned a tailor's shop that I used to work at, you know, while I was, you know, doing band stuff at night. And he came to me one day, and he said, "This woman's driving me crazy." I said, "What's going on?" He says, "Well, she's a neighbor, but she says she has this son, and he's 16 years old, and he's written a couple of songs. Do me a favor. Just come and schmooze the guy, pat him on the head,
like,
tell him he's great. You
humor
know.
Him?"
So I go down there to see this kid, right? He's 16 years old. His name is Graham Gouldman, who later became, you know, 10cc and later became Wax. Great musician. Anyway, he was 16 years old. So we're the Hollies, and we go into this living room in the north of England and say, "Okay, kid.
Show us your stuff.
What do you got?" Right? He said, "Well, I got this song. Goes like this. Bus stop, wet day, she's the..." I said... "Okay, can we have that?
You can work with that.
We can do some stuff to this." I said, "Okay, anything else?" He goes, "Yeah, I got this song called Look Through Any Window, yeah." Now I'm getting amazed because, you know, we know what a good song, what a hit would be, you know, what we could do to it to make it on the radio and make it a hit.
Was it easier back in those days when music was more formulaic, it seemed like?
Yeah, it was life was easier then, you know. It really was. You know, when we started the Hollies, there were only, you know, a couple of thousand bands in England, really. And now there's a couple of thousand in every town, you know, thank God. But then, as I was leaving this living room where this kid just sang me Bust Up and looked through any window, I said, okay, I have to ask you, do you have anything else? He goes, well, I wrote this song this morning, but I gave it to my friend who's singing, his name's Peter Noon, he sings with Herman's Hermits. I said, what's that song? He goes, No Milk Today, My Love. This kid, 16 years old, Graham Gorman.
Wow, cool. So I also noticed the Hollies are going on their 50th anniversary tour. Mm-hmm. Are you going out with them?
You know, I love Tony and Bobby Elliott is the drummer, and Tony Hicks is a lead guitar player. But they're not the original members. The original members of the Hollies were me and Alan Clark and a couple of friends. You know, so and Alan Clark is not going to be there with them because he kind of has retired from the business. So if Alan Clark is not there and I'm not there, it's the Hollies. I mean, and they do really well. They do good business and they play great music. But the heart of the band is not there. If Alan's not there, I'm not there.
Interesting. So you left the band there in 68, is that right?
December the 8th.
And that's after you remember that date?
You'd already been on tour in America at that point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We first came to America in 1965. We played the Paramount Theater in Times Square. And a man called Morris Levy, who owned Roulette Records, invited us to come and play. And it was an incredible moment for us to be sitting at London Airport waiting to fly to America. I mean, it was every band's dream. From the north of England, the first thing you wanted to do was go to London. Wow, big time, right? But once you'd done London, where's the next place you wanted to go? America. And in 1965, we did.
Cool. So you left in 68. Is that when you hooked up with Crosby, Stills, and Young?
I'd actually hooked up with David and Stephen a year before.
Because you guys had crossed each other on the road or something?
No, we were actually... I saw Crosby first in 66 when the Hollies were on tour in America, and he was with the rest of the Birds. They were in Greenwich Village, and he was walking into this head shop, and I knew who he was, I mean, because he's been an iconic image for, you know, 50-odd years. But I didn't have the nerve to go up to him and introduce myself.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it is weird, that.
It's funny.
Anyway, so years later... the Birds were going to play in England. And the unfortunate thing was that the promoter, the English promoter, had advertised them as America's Beatles. Now, you can't do that to England. There was only one Beatles. It's, you know, John, Paul, George, and Ringo, right? There was only one Beatles. And so that kind of upset everybody, and they were kind of behind the eight ball from that moment. I saw Crosby, and he was at a hotel in London called the White House, strangely enough. Hmm. With a lot of older people, and I said, "You got to get out of there. Come and stay with me." I
had to fuddy-duddy.
Yeah, kind of, and it was pretty straight, you know. I mean, it was England in 66, you know, so early 67.
So no throwing things out the window.
Oh no, you know, all the televisions in every hotel room still stayed in its rightful place. I invited Crosby to come and stay with me in my apartment, and then. Our friend Cass Elliott, who was one of the lead singers with the Mamas and the Papas, I personally feel that she knew David had been thrown out of the Birds. She knew the Springfield were breaking up, and she knew I was unhappy with the Hollies because we were friends. I think she put it together in her mind what that vocal blend would sound like.
Oh, she could maybe hear your voices together.
Oh, I think it's unquestionable that she did.
Oh,
that's
cool.
Why on every single piece of product that we put out for the last 20-odd years, 30-odd years, has been dedicated to Cass, because without her...
She kind of heard you guys before you came together.
That's right.
Wow.
And she put us together, too.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
You know, yeah, she was a very dear friend to all three of us.
Hmm. And then when you were in America, you got to sort of expand or change the kind of music you were making and go into different kinds of issues.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that's really interesting to me about your work, kind of overall, like in a broad sense, is that a lot of the music that you've written, songs, they're, you know, backdrops to our lives and stuff, but also you take on serious issues.
I learned from David and Stephen. The Hollies were a really fine band, mm-hmm. but we were really playing, you know, Moon, June, Screw Me in the Back of the Car kind of songs, and great songs.
Like,
I mean,
top of the pop
yeah,
stuff.
We knew how to do that.
Sure.
But after 7 years of that, I was getting a little tired, you know, because I was writing things like King Midas in Reverse.
Which I'm glad you brought that up, because I've always, that's such a real tender part of my heart, and I don't know why. It might be the harmonies.
I think you can recognize yourself in the song.
I think that might be the case. There's a certain sorrowful and a wistfulness in there that...
Yeah, that, and a certain self-recognition, too.
Exactly. Maybe you could talk about how that song came into being.
I was in a town in Yugoslavia called Split, and we were doing a show there, and I was feeling pretty down on myself. I was coming to the end of enjoying what the Hollies were doing, and I wrote King Midas in Reverse, and we made a great record of it, but it wasn't a hit.
It
only got into the top 20 instead of the top 5, right? So, you know, the Hollies viewed that as a failure, and it started to be the decline of my time with the Hollies.
But there's something more soul-searching and visceral about
that's
about
what
that
I
kind
wanted,
of material.
I wanted to do that. I wanted to write songs that really meant something, as well as be played on the radio, as well as be enjoyed musically. I wanted the songs to say something because, I mean, with all due respect, time is the only currency that we have, you know, and I don't want to waste anyone's time, especially not my own. I'm almost 71 now, and who knows how much longer I have left. So for the last, you know, few decades, I've been adamant that I try and utilize my time the best way possible. And I wanted to write deeper meaning songs. And King Midas in Reverse was one of the first ones.
Well, that was always a very intriguing track to me, because it's King Midas in Reverse, King Midas with a curse. But King Midas himself was cursed, because, you know, you think, oh, gee, how great it is that everything you touch turns to gold. Well, what are you having for breakfast? Because as soon as it's...
Solid gold eggs and bacon?
Yeah, that's not going to be very nutritious or fulfilling.
That's right. Yeah, so, and later I wrote a song called I Used to Be a King.
And, is that like a follow-up to it?
Yeah, that was the king I used to be, yeah. Interesting. You know, you can learn a lot from the stuff that you write, even years later.
Well, sometimes when you get distance on it, you can look at it freshly.
Indeed.
I know that whenever I'm the most satisfied with anything that I've ever done, it's when I don't recognize myself in it. I just can see the work itself, and I go, oh, well, that's good, or oh, that's not right. I like where that's coming from.
But, you know, the very fact that you liked King Midas in Reverse, I mean, that was, what, 67?
Yeah, I was
early,
1 year old.
Early 67? Really?
Yeah. I had just turned one. That's how it happens.
You're precocious.
Oh, boy.
Well, and it's interesting, too. You wrote a song about being born. That was the Military Madness. There's a line in there where you say that the Army had your father.
And my mother was having me in Blackpool.
Mother, yeah.
What happened is that during World War II, pregnant ladies were evacuated out of the bombing area, and Manchester and Liverpool particularly.
Because they're industrial.
Not only that, but they were on the Manchester Ship Canal, and that was the thoroughfare in which all the goods and services entered the north of England, basically.
A big target.
You know, it's a big target. And so pregnant ladies were evacuated out of town. That's why, even though I lived in Salford, which is a small suburb of Manchester, I was actually born in Blackpool. Because nobody was bombing Blackpool. It was a Coney Island kind of town, and it wasn't strategically important at all. I don't understand the wisdom of, you know, leaving for 2 weeks to have your baby and then moving back.
Well, that's because they want to protect life, the sanctity of life.
I know, but then you'd move back home where they were still being bombed, you know. It was kind of madness.
It only extends up until the point of birth, and then after that you're on your own.
Yeah, you're on your own, right.
Just part of the madness of the military, yeah.
Yeah, I many years ago, I took both my boys to the hotel that I was born in. And I walked into the hotel, up to the front desk, and I said to the guy that was standing there, I said, I have a really strange question.
What room?
He said, it's around the corner. Walk down the stairs, you'll find it right there. How did you know what I was talking about? He said, do you think you're the first person to come up and ask me this question? I said, I didn't even ask the question. He said, I know, but I know what you were going to ask, because the hotel was turned into a maternity hospital, hospital in quotes. And so to show my two boys the very room that I took my first breath in was very profound to me.
We have a song here I want to cut off to now. another one of your political songs here. This is something off a relatively new Crosby and Nash CD, Don't Dig Here. Why don't we play it, and then you can tell us about it afterwards then.
Sure.
Okay. So, Don't Dig Here. Okay, the Cub Scout troop is heading out here. They want to say goodbye.
Okay. All right, you guys are live. Go.
I'm Titus, and I'm 6, and hello, Hanalei.
Your turn. Go.
I'm Micah. I'm 6. Hello, Hanalei.
I'm Chase. I'm 6, and hello, Hanalei.
I'm Corinne. I'm 6,
And hello, on a lay.
One last time.
I'm Steel, I'm six, and hello, on a lay.
Yay!
And this is awesome! Okay.
Can you tell everybody what the Cub Scout motto is?
We love you.
Do your best.
Do your best.
All right. Do your best. That's do it. Your best there. Yeah, right there, right?
Okay.
That was great.
Nothing like spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for coming in, you guys. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey.
I think 17. I think it's a record.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, well, let's see. The studio's clearing out here now.
The gaggle of the troop.
The six-year-old.
No, they're a pack. It's a pack.
It's a pack of scouts. Do you know what it is of crows?
A murder.
Yes,
a murder of crows.
A
murder of crows,
yeah,
really.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, but I don't think... Are there any Crow Scouts?
Crow Scouts.
I don't think I've heard of them.
I don't think so.
Okay, well, that song we heard then, once we finally got the right cut there, was Don't Dig Here. Graham, what's that about?
David's son, James Raymond, plays piano in Crosby, Stills & Nash Band, and he's a fantastic musician. He read an article in the newspaper one day that they were coming up with a competition to figure out what language they would put on a sign that was supposed to go on the top of Yucca Mountain in Nevada, which is where they wanted to store all the nuclear waste in the country until it got stopped by the... people that have got a brain.
Well, they're still trying, but
they're still trying.
Slowed
but,
down.
Yeah. I later, in a conference in Colorado, met the guy who was responsible for trying to find that language that would say, you know, don't dig here. And I said, so what happened? What happened to that?
So they needed to put a sign over a nuclear repository that would be radioactive
that would
for the next 100,000 years.
Well,
or
they wanted,
like
and they wanted to warn people not to dig here. Don't dig here because, you know, it's poison. It's toxic, right?
Yeah. So what language do you use then?
They didn't. They had to actually give up the process of trying to find a language. They could not find a language that they figured out would be understandable in 10,000 years.
Not even a picture.
They tried
a graphic.
They tried a human kind of face with spikes on it, you know, to scare people. But they didn't know whether that would be attractive to people. Maybe in 10,000 years, they right. tried happy face and smiley face kind of things, and they didn't know whether in 10,000 years that would be acceptable as a, you know, smiley place.
Right.
And they had to actually give up the process.
Yeah, because like pirates, you know, that skull and crossbone used to be what you'd put on poison, but then they found out that kids were very attracted to that because they thought that there was pirates treasure inside
of
there
course.
Or something.
Dig here for gold.
Yeah, and really it's just rat poison.
So when James heard that story, he wrote, don't dig here.
So, they haven't approved that yet, and we've got to find something to do with all this waste because it's piling up all over the world.
Well, it certainly is a problem in Fukushima right now in Japan. Well,
absolutely.
They've got, you know, millions of tons of radioactive water that they've been pouring on the fuel rods there for, you know, the last year. To keep it cool so that it doesn't, you know, ignite and explode. And what are they doing with the water? You know that they're running,
going
they're
going
to
run
out. Yeah, of course it's going into the ocean.
Oh, they've dumped millions of gallons into the ocean. And they figure that's better than letting it go out into the air, but
it's
I don't
terribly
see
short,
the difference.
It's terribly short-sighted.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it just seems like unless you can figure out what to do with the waste products afterwards or what you can do with the mess that you make extracting it out of the ground in the first place, it's not a good idea.
It's a failing technology, and we all know it.
Well, it's super expensive. There's no way that it's economical. They get all these subsidies from the government to
And even
to
worse
operate,
than that, you know, they're trying to tell you that nuclear power plants are clean. They're not telling you what carbon was put into the air to mine the uranium and process the uranium and build all these nuclear power plants.
It's an incredibly intensive industrial process.
Indeed.
Right. When I lived in Colorado for a long time, and there was a... program there in the 60s where they were trying to find civilian uses or, you know, industrial uses of atom bombs because they had all these bombs piled up here and they're, you know, they weren't dropping them on anybody else anymore. So they tried to come up with other uses for it. So they decided, well, we're going to blast a hole in the ground in western Colorado and release some of the natural gases trapped under these big layers of rock.
Yeah, fracking.
Yeah, so they...
Atomic fracking. That's the best idea I've heard
and
all
so they,
day long.
And so they drilled them down. They put four or five bombs in the ground there, and they blew them up, and they retrieved a small amount of gas, but it was all radioactive. They couldn't use it.
Indeed.
And so, you know, they just had to seal up the area and leave people out of there. But now they're starting to go back in closer and closer to that area and extract natural gas.
I think the present project of fracking in America, which is, you know, hydraulic fracturing, which is, you know, fracking, is going to prove to be incredibly dangerous. I mean, when the industry won't even tell you what chemicals they're putting into the earth that are leaking into the groundwater, when they won't even tell you, when it's secret, you know something's wrong.
Well, right. With a name like fracking, it doesn't really sound very good.
Yeah. I don't think so.
There was also another project they tried to do in Kona at the Kauai High Harbor. They were going to use a nuclear bomb to clear the harbor back in the 60s.
Who are these brilliant people?
They were thinking, we could dredge out this harbor. I was doing an environmental assessment of the harbor there, and I come across this document where they're evaluating the use of nuclear bombs to dredge the harbor.
Insane,
and,
isn't it?
And unfortunately, they never did it. They used chemical explosives instead.
It's kind of shocking. So. Recently, some documents have become declassified where the U.S. had plans at one point to detonate a nuclear bomb on the moon. I just read last night.
What did the residents of the moon think of that?
Oh, Newt Gingrich. Newt doesn't like that.
No, but you know who was in support of that was the Moon Fuhrer.
The Moon Fuhrer, yeah.
What did you read last night?
Last night it was more declassified documents from the Johnson administration where they had a first strike. There was documents to their plan to bomb the rest of the world in case anybody attacked the U.S.
In case the president was assassinated.
Yeah.
No matter who did it.
Yeah, no matter who did it, they were going to nuke everyone.
China and Russia.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had a political idea called MAD, M-A-D, which was mutual assured destruction.
Right.
That if we were going to die, then you're going to die, and we're both going to die, so we're dead.
And then I saw recently that there was a Soviet co-captain, the number two charge guy, who refused to give the launch codes back during the that whole mess in the Cuba missiles crisis. And so if he had followed orders, that sub would have launched missiles. And so it's kind of incredible all of the stuff that we didn't do, and even some of the things that I'm guessing that we did do, like using nuclear bombs to mine for natural gas. I'm kind of, my jaw is on the floor with that one.
Yeah, well, they got away with it. They did it, you know, and now they're starting to mine in that area again. And it's bound to be radioactive still, for that matter.
You know, I know that right after Fukushima happened in Japan, one of the world's most expensive fish was sold. It was a blue-eyed tuna that sold for like $1.2 million. I'll bet you any money they did not test it for radiation.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing they're not testing any of the food from Japan. I wouldn't eat it if I knew where it was.
People are, and they're finding that, you know, a lot of the tuna is really irradiated.
Right. So you're kind of a nuclear activist in some regards then.
I'll tell you how it started.
I mean, yeah, but let me, before you do, is it just nuclear power, nuclear weapons,
it's all a snake.
Okay.
I like that.
And you have the head at one end, which is, you know, miners dying from mining the uranium from radon gases, all the way through to trying to store it and trying to protect it from terrorists. It's just one snake, right?
Eating itself.
And one day I was having dinner with Jacques Cousteau, and I said to Jacques, I said, tell me what you think the biggest problem facing us, humanity. What do you think is the biggest problem? Now, I'm expecting some whale answer, some ocean answer, some, you know, some sea tale, right? He looked at me and he said, nuclear police. And I said, Jacques, what are you talking about? Because this is 77. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, I foresee a day when people in the nuclear police will be able to come to your house and see if you have any fissionable material stored. And it started me and Jackson and Bonnie and James Taylor, and we ended up doing the No Nukes concerts in Madison Square Gardens and, you know, raising a lot of money to help spread the news about the dangers of nuclear power. Most of the people that are proponents of nuclear power are making fortunes from it.
Yeah, and it's hard to argue against someone who's deriving immense profit from the
That's
situation.
Right.
Well, it's hard to get them to see the light when they're pocketing the change.
Indeed.
Well, the U.S. Military this week did a nuclear test. You know, they blew up some nuclear material.
Did they study hard for it?
In Nevada. I don't think they do. No, they just do this on a whim.
In Nevada?
In Nevada, yeah. It was a nuclear test this week, you know, and it didn't...
Underground, obviously.
Underground, yeah. And they used, you know, a bomb to study the effects of the, how the plutonium reacts and all. And, you know, it's all totally against the nuclear non-proliferation
treaty. I was
going to
say, I thought there were
yeah,
no
they're
more...
not supposed to be doing this at all. And then the Iranians say... What the hell? You know, you're threatening to bomb us for a nuclear power plant here, and you guys are still testing nuclear weapons over there?
Wow.
I mean, how hypocritical is that?
100%?
Completely.
Let's let our guests answer that.
Well, the thing is that in a really odd way, I find us hypocritical that we can say, look, we have 5,000 nuclear weapons or more, and the Soviet Union has 5,000, but you're not allowed to have one. And right. I understand the delicate political, you know, of a country that wants to get rid of Israel. I understand all that. But it seems to me terribly ironic that this country, being the only country ever to, you know, destroy people with a hydrogen bomb and an atomic bomb.
Aggressively, as an act of war.
Yeah.
And it was a civilian population, too,
not even
a military target.
Absolutely.
And Iran doesn't even have a bomb. They don't even have a nuclear bomb program. I mean, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. And so
it doesn't mean that the program's not there just because you can't find evidence. But it is a big indicator.
How do you convict somebody with no evidence? You know, we're talking about invading a country, using nuclear weapons against them because they might be making them.
But we invaded Iraq.
Yeah, under the same premise, right?
What a short memory people have around here, you know, that they can't see the pattern between these two countries.
That's right.
Well, I wanted to read this quote here because I was particularly struck by it. And this is a quote from you in a recent Huffington Post article where you say, I became a citizen of the United States of America decades ago. When year, like in the 70s?
83, I think.
Okay. Because I did not want to be hypocritical, criticizing this country, throwing caustic comments from the sidelines, usually in song, yet not being a true part of the wonderful social network. I wanted to be able to vote, and I wanted to be able to praise the obvious beauty of this country and its people and the things they stand for, having brilliantly been set out in our Constitution. And that really struck me. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the sentiment behind that.
I got to tell you, remember we were talking earlier about what you did from the Manchester as a rock and roll band. The first thing you wanted to do was go to London, and when you'd done that, the next thing you wanted to do was go to America. I've always loved America. When I first set foot in Los Angeles, I came out of Los Angeles airport, I climbed the nearest palm tree and told Alan Clark I was not going home. I loved this country.
What was it? It must have been at a very early age something struck you.
I think there's an inherent freedom in America to speak your mind, to have your ideas be listened to or not listened to. There was an incredible freedom here combined with an incredible beauty of the physical country and the people here. I loved America. When the Hollies toured America in 66, I met people that were just unbelievably great people. And I wanted to be a part of it. And I didn't want to be, you know, like I said, throwing grenades usually in song from the sidelines without being a real part of this country.
You talk about the wonderful, let me get this right, the wonderful social network. What do you mean by that?
Basically, the heart of the people. I think everybody in this country wants their children to have a better future than they did. They want their children to be educated. They want their children to be well fed. It's that basic surge into the future that humanity has that is undeniable in this country. In the last, you know, decade or so, it's gotten real ugly, you know, particularly politically. But it's still an incredible country. This is an amazing... I have a better view of America than you two guys do. Because I don't come from here originally. You do. I see it differently than you do.
Sure. Let me ask you a question. You're pretty informed on a lot of issues, just from a few discussions we've had. Where do you get your information? Where do you get news from? Do you watch nightly news?
I'm a news junkie.
Do you watch TV? Or?
I listen to everything. I listen to NPR every single day. I love people like Amy Goodman from Democracy Now. I loved Keith Olbermann. I loved Jon Stewart. I love Stephen Colbert. I love absolutely Rachel Maddow. I watch Fox News occasionally, but I have to switch off because it is insane.
Gives you a stomach ache.
It is insane. So, I mean, even during Watergate, I had all three channels all tuned, listening to every word that was spoken on Watergate. I'm a news junkie, and I admit it. It doesn't go down well with my wife, but that's okay.
Okay, we've got a phone call here. Let's go talk to the listeners.
If you're just tuning in, we're joined today with a special guest, Graham Nash. I'm Jonathan Jay, Dave Giroux on Out of the Box at KKCR, and you are on the air. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Hello, how you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen, good afternoon. I had a question for Mr. Graham regarding his unique perspective as being from the old country and then, of course, now an American citizen. The thing that struck me, I briefly lived in England in the fall of 72, and I was struck by the class consciousness. And then at that time, reading the newspapers, it seemed like people were still quite concerned about World War II. And I tell my friends, well, when the Beatles came over, or you guys, you know, for the British invasion in the early 60s, England was still on food rationing. And so from all these different perspectives of the English and the Americans, I was wondering if you could make a few comments. The thing that struck me was that they said that because of, for a number of reasons, which I won't elucidate or go into, is the fact that they said that like something like 75% of people in Great Britain would leave the country if they could.
Very interesting. I think you hit it on the head there. Here's basically what happened.
Yes, sir.
There was a kind of an imaginary dividing line that was like just north of Birmingham. And if you didn't speak the Queen's English, you were considered a peasant. Now, when the Beatles came along, they destroyed that class consciousness line in a way.
With their accents?
Everybody wanted to talk like John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Everybody. Oh. So they opened up a tremendous cultural door.
May I ask an aside question?
Yes.
Now, in terms of the pronunciation of that far north, would you characterize the accent or inflection in the speech of those of you folks up of the north, northerly area? Would you be more influenced by Scotland?
Absolutely. I'm from Manchester, and it's only 180 odd miles from Scotland. And don't forget, the English, well, actually the Romans, built a wall across England to keep them out.
Yes.
Yeah, Hadrian's Wall.
Indeed.
Yeah, not to keep them in either.
No.
I want to personally give a shout-out to you. Thank you guys so much, because if it wasn't for you, you had the cachet to bring the influence of the black music from America to America, whereas the white Americans, other than Mr. Presley and some other folk, they really could not offer some of the traditions of the black folk in America to the Americans.
I kind of agree, but I disagree on a very important point. I think that Elvis Presley and his influence actually did. When Sam Phillips, who I spoke to several times while he was alive, wanted to find a white man, good-looking white man, that could sing like a black man. And he got it all in Elvis Presley. So even though I kind of agree with you, I have to make that particular point.
Well, I mean, that's just my I just thought, you know, I was born in 46, and I played drums since 57, and I just thought that from the late 50s on, that period of confluence with all the different strains of music coming in was extremely exciting. You know what I mean?
It's why I'm sitting in front of this microphone today, my friend.
Even though I'm a sort of a jazz nut, I sort of prefer, I mean, I listen to rock, but I prefer the nuance of jazz. So
it's a shame about Dave Brubeck dying this week, isn't it?
Well, the thing that used to kill me, that Joe Morello, he looked like an accountant, but he played like an angel.
Yes, he did.
You know what I mean? It's like, you know, I love the perspicacity, or how can I say it, the kind of like simple kind of reduction of the elements of his drumming technique to the basics.
Yeah, he was an incredible one. So was Paul Desmond.
I'll tell you, sir, you know, you especially and all your brothers, thank you so much for all the incredible music. And, of course, one time I was in Hanalei over 20 years ago and we were talking about music, and you just came up in the post office there, and you just seem like such a wonderful person. I know you are a wonderful person.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm a human being just trying to do my best.
Thank you so much, Graham.
You're very welcome. Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye.
All right, we have...
Okay, the phone number here is 826-7771. Anybody wants to call in? Oh, a caller, you're on the air.
Oh, aloha. Thank you so much for this program.
Sure.
And I just wanted to thank Graham for all of his energy and enthusiasm for our great radio station for so many years. It's been it's been totally appreciated by everyone, and I just wanted to add that.
Thank you very much, ma'am. God bless Janet Planet.
You betcha. Thanks. Aloha.
Aloha.
Okay.
Interesting people, eh?
Yeah, they love you.
You never know who you're talking to when you're talking over here.
So you've been on Kauai quite a while then.
35 years.
35
how
years.
How did away. You come to Kauai? How Kauai? Why Kauai? What's the story behind that?
My girlfriend and I, Joni Mitchell, came here to visit Buffy St. Marie in 1969. And we stayed with Buffy. She lived in Kapa'i, at the back of Kapa'a there. I fell in love with the island. But, you know, as a tourist, what happens is you look at this island for the first time. You go, holy Toledo, I need to buy something here. I need some of this. Then you go home and you kind of get on with your life and you forget about it. And you come back 10 years later and it's 10 times the price. But I came in successive years. And one time I came in 76 with my wife, Susan, who was going to be my wife. She was my girlfriend at the time. And I realized that if I wanted to marry Susan and probably start to have kids, I wanted a place where water was never going to be a problem. I lived in San Francisco, and I used to see billboards that said, shower with a friend, we're running out of water. And it sounds like a funny thing to see on a billboard, but it was profoundly serious. I saw what we were doing with the Colorado River on the border of Mexico and California.
Sure.
I lived in San Francisco, so all the people up there were trying to figure out, why are we sending all our water down to this desert? And I decided that if I was going to get married and be serious about life, I wanted to live in a place where several things happened. One, that water wasn't going to be a problem. Two, that the people were friendly. Three, that your credit card worked. Four, that the government was relatively stable. And I found it all on Kauai.
Oh, yeah, we definitely have a stable government here.
Well, at least no one's running around with bazookas.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean that in a very real way.
Oh, good.
Well, there's a lot of places in the world 35 years ago where you wouldn't have gotten that list.
And not only that, but I can speak my mind here. Nobody has to listen to me. I'm a musician. Right. You know, I have to try and stay well informed about what's going on in the world. But I'm a musician, you know. You don't have to listen to me. I don't have any answers, but I sure do have a lot of questions.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's see. Another topic that you've been following here that you're associated with is Bradley Manning. So tell us a little bit about Bradley Manning and what your involvement in him is.
Bradley Manning is a U.S. soldier. He was part of the intelligence...
I guess you could say community.
Yeah, community in Baghdad. And he saw things that were going on in our name by the military that were totally abhorrent to him. And he decided one day that he wanted to do something about it. He went in the normal consequence up the chain of command and was rebuked by the people that were in charge of him. And so he made the decision, I believe, to release a lot of cables. And allegedly, he gave them all to WikiLeaks. We're a nation of laws. We're supposed to be a nation of laws. But it seems very much that some of the laws apply to the common people and some of them don't. And some of the laws don't apply to the rich people. And particularly in Bradley's case, let me tell you, the Code of Military Justice, Section 813, Article 13, states quite emphatically, no punishment before trial. Everyone's entitled to a speedy trial in this country. A speedy trial usually means between 100 and 120 days from whatever the day of the crime was. Bradley Manning has been in jail now for over 900 days, and he still has not been brought to trial. And he's been kept for the first 9 months of his incarceration in appalling conditions. An 8 foot by 6 foot white cell, bright lights 24 hours a day, with somebody every night, every 5 minutes waking him up to find out if he's okay. They tried to destroy this man's mind.
Yeah, that's sleep deprivation. That's torture.
They nearly succeeded.
It was awful what happened to Bradley.
Right.
And
he was deprived of clothing for much of that time.
He was totally humiliated. I mean, I think they tried to break him because they wanted him to finger Julian Assange from WikiLeaks. I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, but it seems like it's some kind of crazy witch hunt is what it really looks like from the outside.
They can't afford, and it's one of the things I was talking about before. I really supported Obama in 2008. Me and David did many things for him, you know, benefits, etc., etc., and I supported him this year also. We did many benefits. But I have things, you know, that I'd like to talk to Barack about his two-sided face where he says, you know, I just signed the whistleblowers thing where we need whistleblowers except him. We need to get the truth. These are the only people that are showing us what's going on except him, you know. They can't afford to let Bradley Manning and Julian Assange win. They're tearing back the curtain and showing what's going on by the American military in our name and with our tax dollars. They right. can't afford to let him win. But this part about them being unlawful in incarceration and what a UN charter, investigation called torture, right? I think that they have, and also when Barack went on national television saying that he had broken the law.
Yeah, how can
which military commander is going to go against this commander in chief?
Well, who elected him to make judicial determinations? That's not in his job scope.
I know, and especially because he's a constitutional lawyer.
So he ought to know better.
He should know better.
Yeah.
And I love Barack, and I'm so glad that, you know, that he got reelected because, you know, the alternative, you know, it was a nightmare. But I have my issues with him.
Yeah. We have a caller.
Go ahead, Hello? Caller. You're on the air.
Aloha, gentlemen. The question is regarding the tradition of the Magna Carta, and it seems that under a certain law that Mr. Obama signed that they could pick up an American citizen, for example, and throw the key away. They don't have to bring you to a court of justice, and they don't have to give you access to a lawyer. Would you comment on this? I've heard Felicia and Carlos speak of this. When I tell people, they refuse to believe it. They go, oh, that only applies to combatants on the military field. But I tell them, no, that's not true at all. And people just, no, they don't want to believe it.
It's called the National Defense Authorization Act.
Right. And the thing that kills me is like, you know, it's like I used to think America was such a great place because unlike a lot of countries like in Europe, for example, there's a Napoleonic system of justice where you're assumed to be guilty before the fact. And so I just think this is more than sad. This is ridiculous.
I think there are many senators that are trying to take that particular provision of the National Defense Authorization Act out of the act.
Well, I'm not insane. That my understanding is correct that they can do these things.
I'm afraid your understanding is correct.
The thing is, I used to think, well, yeah, Britain, you know, I mean, I watch BBC every night, and I'm a news junkie like you, Mr. Nash, but the thing is, you know, I think, well, at least, you know, we have the Bill of Rights, whereas the Brits, they don't have a constitution or a Bill of Rights, but then I think, well, what's the difference now?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the thing that gives me quite a degree of chagrin is, as I said earlier in another call, that the thing is, When Britain controlled most of the world like America does now, they said, well, don't worry, we're all a part of the same Ohana. So now it seems to me there's a lot of folks who don't like the people of color, the white people in Britain don't like the people of color, and there's a lot of prejudice, and therefore a lot of them want to leave Great Britain, right?
That's interesting. I have not heard that about people wanting to leave because England is a very beautiful country and it has its problems just like the United States does.
Citing a survey, sir, which indicated that 75% of the people would leave Great Britain if they could.
Very interesting.
Well, the point is, because the thing, like, I lived there in 72. The next year they put the VAT tax, and I tell Americans, you're complaining about nothing. You want to see taxes? You go to Great Britain. You can't even watch the TV without paying a VAT, without paying a TV license.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
but I think the bottom line is I would never vote for Obama. I never did vote for Obama. I would never vote for that nightmare Romney, of course. But the thing is, when someone can sign, I mean, I just consider Obama to be a corporate president. And since I'm rather a poor person, not a super rich person, yeah, he's my man. But I just don't like the fact that he's like, he really is not an FDR kind of individual.
So what did you do? Did you just give up?
No, I didn't vote for president.
I think you gave up.
Well, you're entitled to your opinion, sir.
Yeah. If you didn't vote,
I didn't vote for president.
If you didn't vote, you can't say shit, man.
Well, then
we can't say that on the air either.
Oh, excuse me.
Anyway, I just think it's sad.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll take those comments off the air.
Thank you, caller. I wanted to get back to Bradley Manning because I did not know this until I was doing some research a couple nights ago. It turns out that he has dual citizenship with the U.S. and Wales. He has Welsh citizenship. And it wasn't until an MP from Wales complained about the treatment he was receiving in Quantico that they finally had to relent and move him to a different facility.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's really amazing. I mean, the U.S. succumbed to political pressure from the U.K., to treat its political prisoners more graciously.
Indeed.
How often does that make it into the news?
Yeah, it doesn't.
Now, isn't Bradley in court this week?
It's a pretrial hearing to see whether he is going to come to court, because his lawyer said that he didn't know who the U.S. government was putting on trial, because as far as he was concerned, Bradley Manning's mind was almost gone. And that's why I wrote with James Raymond the song Almost Gone. And there's a YouTube video of if you type in Almost Gone, you'll see the video that we made for it that has had over, I think, 40,000 hits right now.
Well, a lot of the time that he was in prison, they, you know, used an excuse that he was suicidal.
Even though his psychologist said that he was not.
Yeah, they had to keep him, you know, naked with no sheets in his room. You know, under 24-hour watch with spotlights on all the time, because he might have committed suicide.
Please understand something, that he did make a noose out of his bedsheets when he was in a cage in Kuwait.
Yeah.
Because it was awful for him. He wanted to end his life.
Right.
However, when he was brought to the United States, several of his psychiatrists that were attached to his case said that this kid is not a suicidal risk and should not be being treated like this.
Right. Well, it was an excuse that their jailers were using to treat him poorly.
What motivated you to write the song Almost Gone? And
It's not fair.
What are you trying to bring to light there?
The truth. Bradley Manning showed the truth to the American people. He showed them what was going on with all those cables, and particularly with that collateral murder video that he leaked.
So what is Almost Gone?
Almost Gone is a song that Crosby, Nash, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash have been doing for the last several years.
No, I mean, what
his mind was
his
almost
mind is
gone.
Almost gone.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you get deprivation for, you know, a year and see how you feel.
2 years, almost 3 years now, huh?
Well, he hasn't been kept in those horrible conditions for the last 11 months.
Well, that's a small step forward. I thought it was interesting, though, that it was pressure from the UK that helped that situation.
Yeah, Lady MP from Wales, yes.
And then I wanted to ask you that you recently have become an OBE.
Yes.
And that's the Order of the
British Empire.
And that's an honorific title that was bestowed.
Yes, I had to meet with Her Majesty, the Queen, in Buckingham Palace. And
so you lay the sword on your shoulder?
No, that is for sirs.
For sirs?
I'm not a sir.
Oh, okay.
That's one of the next steps.
I see.
But I found it incredible talking to the Queen and having the Queen ask me about the Hollies.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
Well, she did.
I was going to say, what do you think that you, back then, as a member of the Hollies, what would you think of yourself today? And it was, if you could be a fly on the wall witnessing that.
What was more important, and I kept this in the front of my mind when I was in Buckingham Palace, is what the hell my mother and father would have thought.
Mm.
They would have been so proud. There's a lot of people that say that the monarchy is done and it's 1,000 years old. It should be done away with. But it's 1,000 years old. When I stood in front of the Queen, she was 84 years old. She had a twinkle in her eye. She looked fabulous.
It's good to be the Queen.
She
when was that?
2010.
Okay.
And I just kept thinking of how proud my mother and father would be, regardless of what people think about, royal awards.
Now,
well, I don't mean to poo-poo at all. I think it's kind of interesting, and it's not an experience I've had.
I found it to be a great honor.
You said at the time that everything that you learned that was right and good in the world that you learned as a child in the UK, and so you had great respect. Does that go back to your parents?
Absolutely.
I thought that might be the case.
Absolutely.
Now, I saw an article on the internet just a couple of days ago that no law is passed in England that isn't approved by the Queen herself. Is that true?
It's a kind of she is the head of everything, but she doesn't have a great deal of political power. And I'm sure she's aware of everything that goes on, but she doesn't have a lot of political power. But I'm certain that she could pull strings.
If she didn't like something, she could get it
changed.
I'm
certain she would speak her mind.
Right. Well, she's got a lot of political power. She's her and her family are probably the richest people on the planet.
I stood in a room with paintings that totally astounded me. There were Rubens, there were Rembrandts, there were Caravaggios. Unbelievable to stand in that room.
Yeah, and what's in the basement, too? I'd like to see them there.
Yes,
you know.
What?
Well, let's see. It's 5 o'clock, and I need to say that you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. This is the Out of the Box Show with Dave Giroux and Jonathan Jay.
Actually, Dave, I was hoping we could get Graham to do that.
Sure, yeah. You want to say that then?
Well, sure. You're listening to Kauai Community Radio here. It's island-wide. It's 91.9 FM. In Anahola, it's 92.7 FM. In Hanalei, of course, it's 90.7. And even you can listen to it in Oahu, and it's 104.7. This is Kauai Community Radio.
All right. That was great. Hey, we have a phone call. Let's go to the call.
Hey, I kind of tuned in a little late here. I just was curious, if you have a view of the history of the United States, we fought the Revolutionary War against the British Empire. We fought the War of 1812 against the British Empire. The Civil War would have never happened if it hadn't been for the British Empire subsidizing the secessionist Southerners. So how come just a few years later we come to their rescue in World War One? I'm really mystified about that.
Ain't life grand?
And it would seem to me that, as I understand it, the British Empire still basically controls Africa, and that the State of Israel was essentially the UN and Great Britain's bastard child, and I'm just mystified why we would take Britain as an ally.
It's an interesting question. I think that when people rule the world, wouldn't you want to ally yourself with them?
Well, not if they're slave traders and if they're drug peddlers. I don't think I want to align myself.
Do you know any country in this world that isn't what you just said?
Well, I think it's harsh to blame that on countries, and maybe it.
You seem to be good at doing it, though.
The blame, I think, belongs more on individuals, and I think there are intelligence organizations out there that indicate that the British royal family has a long history of that kind of funding. Not that the U.S. government doesn't fund its covert operations the same way. We saw how Oliver North took the fall for Ronald Reagan and their essentially drug smuggling to fund the Contra army in Nicaragua.
You're talking about the Iran-Contra affair back in the 80s.
Yes.
Yeah. And from what I understand, that's never stopped.
Probably not.
But it continues to this day.
Probably not. What do you think is going on in Afghanistan? with the opium trade.
Well, from what I understand, it's the exact same thing.
Yeah. And
you know, it's American military guarding the poppy fields.
Yep.
That's big money there. Billions of dollars in that crop.
So you raise an interesting kind of crisis, you know, for the citizen of the country. How do we as individuals respond to that, the things that go on outside of our name and usually outside of our sight, but done in our name? I mean, that's a real ethical conundrum.
And that's what Bradley Manning was doing. He was trying to tell the people, look what's going on in our name with our tax dollars. Look what's going on here. And for that, I mean, with all due respect, I mean, this kid, for trying to bring the truth to the American people, is probably facing life imprisonment and has been tortured, right? At the same time, George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and all the other neocons are walking this planet free.
And Mike Huckabee.
Who do you have to blame for that? You have to blame Barack Obama for not pursuing any prosecution. What did he say? Oh, I want to look forward. I don't want to look backward.
You know, this is the first statement that you've made that I kind of agree with. I agree with that they should have been brought to trial for war crimes.
Well, you know, from what I understand, there is no statute of limitations on murder.
Is that right?
That's right.
So, interesting.
Well, I think what Obama's thinking is that he himself will be liable. He'll be called to justice if he... calls up George Bush.
Mr. Obama just last week topped his 300th drone strike.
I know.
Yeah, he's culpable.
Terrible.
So that's essentially murder. The Pentagon's own number is that in the last 10 years, and this is a very conservative number, that the United States is responsible for at least 300,000 deaths in various nations overseas, and that is with no appreciable threat to the United States.
I agree. And you know what? The truth is that that's a very low number. I think there's far more people than 300,000 died in Iraq alone.
Well, like I say, that's the Pentagon's number.
Well, they're famous
for
saying
that
they...
will admit to the 300,000.
But they're famous for saying they don't do body counts as well.
Right.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, those are homicides, because according to the U.S. Constitution, if there's no declaration of war by Congress, then there is no legitimacy in armed conflict.
Yes.
So those deaths are murders.
Yes, I would agree.
Hey, we have another call behind you. You got any closing
Thanks
remarks?
You know, I pray a lot these days.
Good. Don't give up, kid.
You guys have a good afternoon.
You too.
Okay, I just wanted to remind people, I didn't quite get to that far in my last statement, is that we are talking with Graham Nash, and he'll be on the show here till 6 o'clock. So the phone lines are open at 826-7771. So caller, you are on the air.
Hey, Graham, it's wonderful to hear you on the radio. What I would like to hear you talk about is anything local. What are your opinions on what's going on local? Because I know you're a choir resident also. And, you know, I'm going to just hang up and listen to what you got to say.
Thank you. We were talking about this just before we came on the air, and the truth is, for the last couple of years, I've been so busy on the road with David and Stephen. I mean, I've been gone since January of last year. And, I'm not really... completely up to date on what's going on with GMOs, and I'm not really up to date what's going on with the power utilities and their cooperative nature. But I do know this. I love the Hawaiian people. I work with lots of them. When Iniki happened and me and my friends raised $1 million and gave it away here in Kauai, it was profoundly thrilling for me to be able to help this island. There's something about this island that I truly, truly love. I've lived all over the world. I only feel at home right here. So I'm going to get back up to speed on some of the issues that are facing this population and do my best to find out more and find out as much information as I can, and then I'll be able to speak to it. But thank you for your question.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here. I'm going to play the song Almost Gone, about Bradley Manning. So check this out.
Oh, they want it now.
That's not it either?
Nope.
I'm batting zero.
No, 0 for 2, but you still got a chance, Dave.
You got it.
There, how's that sound?
In a white room, underneath the glaring light, every 5 minutes, they're asking me if I'm alright. Locked up in a white room, naked as the day I was born. 24 bright lights, 24 all alone. What I did was show some truth.
A live version.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Almost Gone, song about Bradley Manning.
That's nice.
Now, we were talking about this issue here. Now, the other, or one of the other people involved here is Julian Assange.
Yes.
Who is he still holed up in the Ecuadorian consulate in London?
Yes, he is.
And so he's trying.
Let me tell you something. Here's what's going on. These sexual charges out of Sweden, by the original prosecutors, dropped for absolute lack of evidence.
And I heard that the women weren't interested in testifying.
Not only were they not interested in testifying, they invited him back into their bed for 2 weeks. Now, which woman ever was raped and invited their rapist back into their bed? Right? You know what's going on here? Prime Minister of Sweden, Karl Rove. Great friends.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. You'll find out. It will come out. You will find out that Karl Rove is behind this whole thing.
Really?
Yes.
So he's the nasty kingmaker inside it all.
Well, isn't he? I just spent, what, $400 million of somebody else's money on
not getting somebody elected? Yes. Way to go, Carl.
Well, they tried to buy it. They really tried to buy the presidency.
Hmm. Well, they got close, and, you know, wasn't that far off. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, aloha.
Hey.
I'm sure enjoying the show.
Oh, that's nice. Thanks.
Right on, man. Hey, the last caller was talking about, you know, what Graham thought about the local scene. And I also remember Graham saying, God bless Janet Planet. And I've been a member of KKCR from the beginning. And Graham, let me just catch up to speed that now every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night, right at dinner time, we got all kind of weird jazz going on. And
too much,
a lot
you think?
Of us can't, a lot of us can't even turn on a radio, you know? I mean,
is it too much, do you think?
It's way too much, bro.
That's interesting. Well, I'm sure the people here are listening.
Okay.
That's an interesting
point. That's the only negative thing I was going to say.
So what would you suggest that takes its place?
More stuff like you're going to hear after your show, Acoustic Luau.
Interesting.
Or Hawaiian sponsored type stuff, you know.
How nice.
Something that represents our island, not Chicago and New York and...
Well,
you know.
there is room for everything, of course, but I'm sure that the people that are listening, you know, the people that program the radio station are gonna take notice of what you said. Thank you.
We've even taken it a step farther. We got a page on Facebook, Too Much Jazz on KKCR.
Fantastic.
So if anyone's on Facebook, we've got like 30-something supporters. Papa Molly, that was recently with Bill Kreutzmann, you know, the Seven Walkers.
Oh, yeah, sure, I know Billy.
He signed on.
I've known Billy since 1969.
Yeah, I just bought my ticket to the Homegrown Festival this Saturday. It's going to be good.
Yeah.
So, you know...
Well, you have an interesting...
One thing I'm really stickler about is if you're going to, you know, be negative and throw rocks at people like this radio station's attack the shrimp farms and a lot of different things that, you know, bike paths and all kinds of stuff. They need to be Pono with what they're doing with their own programming.
How interesting. I'm sure they're listening, my friend.
And just on a side note, Graham, I remember a long time ago you got a speedboat, and I think you were checking it out, going out Honolulu Bay, and you hit kind of a big swell.
Yeah, I remember.
Is that a painful memory? Do you not want to talk about that? Or?
Well, it's just with me every day, and it will be with me every day in my life. I broke both legs.
Oh, my God, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, I have pins and rods and screws in both legs.
Oh, I'm sorry for bringing it up.
Let's make security, airport security interesting.
I set off the alarms every single time.
Is that for what's in your legs or what's in your heart?
Probably both.
Well, God bless. And,
thank you, man.
Hope people are listening.
Mahalo.
Okay. Aloha.
Well, we can talk a little bit about that. We got more.
We do have another call.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, caller. You're on the
air. Hey there. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead, caller.
All right. I just want to wish Graham a happy Hanukkah. And thank you for coming in. Seriously, thank you for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Hearing you just talk and relax over there. And I especially like hearing your thoughts and your feelings about voting and how important voting is.
I can't tell you how important it is.
It's wonderful to hear you talking about it and put it in terms of giving up, not giving up.
Yeah, no.
Which is really, you know, the foundation of this whole thing since, you know, before the 60s, you know.
I'm going to ask the Dave and Jonathan here to close the show. In you know, whenever it is, with a Peter Gabriel song called "Don't Give Up."
Really? Well, that's great. That's great, and I'm really glad that you framed it like that, because with all this stuff that we don't like going on, there is a lot of good stuff going on.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you feel it on Kauai too.
There's
really a lot of great stuff going on, and you know,
I can be anywhere in the world, my friend, and I choose to be here.
Yeah, and it's just wonderful.
Thank you.
So, welcome back.
Thank you. Mahalo.
All right. Happy holidays.
And we have another caller on there. Welcome to Out of the Box with our guest today, Graham Nash. Go ahead.
Aloha, Graham. I'm Al from Kaloa, and I just want to say how great it is you live on our island. We live on your island, whatever the case may be.
No, this is not my island, my friend. I'm very lucky to be here.
Well, I've just been reading a lot of Rolling Stone lately, and, you know, with these things coming out, you know, Led Zeppelin and the guy from The Who, Peter Townsend. I just can't believe the caliber of musicians that have come from England. And maybe that sounds a little chauvinistic coming from an American, but, man, where'd you guys get all the talent over there?
You know what it is? I'll tell you exactly what it is. After World War II happened, you know, 14, 15-year-old kids had nothing to do, especially where I came from. I come from one of the most bleak slums in the north of England. We had nothing to do. I mean, if we had a ball to kick around, that was great. And then a couple of things happened. There was a man called Lonnie Donegan, who was kind of a folk singer from the United Kingdom. And he brought skiffle to our lives. And what he brought was not only incredible music, but the ability to play that music, because it was pretty cheap. If you could afford a cheap acoustic guitar and a washboard that you would put thimbles on your fingers for the drums, and a chest with a mop pole and a piece of string for the bass, you could make music. And we did. And all of a sudden, all these kids that had nothing to do found an incredible passion in music. Now you add, all our friends had brothers who were in the Merchant Marines and were going to America and bringing all these records back. And then when you add to that American rock and roll, you had this incredible perfect storm of energy and music, and we grabbed it because it saved our lives.
It was literally a life-saving type of deal. I mean, that after the war, there was so much devastation in England, I guess, from what I read. And this was sort of like not just an outlet. It was almost like a necessity.
Yeah,
in a sense.
And we needed to laugh, too. You know, it was important to laugh. That's why early comedic troops like the Goons, which later became, you know, Monty Python's, you know, the other end of the scale, you know, 20, 30 years later, the Goons made us laugh. And it was important to laugh because it was devastating.
I can't even imagine. But just the caliber of the professionalism, I mean, from the Stones to Ronnie Lane to, you know, Faces to you to all the other brethren, I mean, you've added so much to the English language, if I can say that.
Well, I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank
Mahalo.
You, man. Mahalo.
Okay.
Let me get another caller standing
yes.
by.
Caller, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Gary. I'm from Kapai. And a question for Graham, a little historical question. Circa 1970, Monterey Pop Festival. Does he remember any negative things that occurred back then?
The Monterey Pop Festival was actually a couple of years earlier than that, in 67. I didn't go to Monterey.
You weren't there? Okay.
No, I wasn't. My friend Crosby was, and he has great, and my friend Cass Elliott was, and Jimi Hendrix was. They had great stories about what happened at Monterey. Monterey was an incredible turning point in presenting rock and roll and that kind of music to the public. I mean, even Ravi Shankar did a brilliant set, you know, who passed away this week at the age of 92, did an incredible set. Janis Joplin, I mean, and The Who and Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah, you know? I understand what you're saying. I'm asking about the band that you were associated with.
Oh, the Hollies, yes. No, the Hollies were not invited to play Monterey, and I wish I'd have attended that, because I like to be at moments of history. I mean, you know,
who doesn't?
Okay,
yeah.
And I did use the word, and you didn't allude to it, and I'm going to excuse you from it.
Which word?
And
which word?
I used the word negative.
Oh, yeah. No. There wasn't much negative shit going on at Monterey. Not at all.
Yeah.
It was mostly a very, very positive concert. Absolutely.
Well, I know it was, but now, being in the industry at that time, there's other stories, and we can talk to it about it off the air. Okay.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, you were talking about the kind of the mood in England in, you know, the 60s. I mean, we had a similar thing going on here with the, you know, all the baby boomers coming of age, you know, similarly having little to do or not having to do anything that they don't want to. And then the war going on and all the negative feedback from the Vietnam War at the time.
Which the war, because we, you know, seems like we keep having them.
I know it, yeah, and it hasn't ended yet. And so, you know, that was, you know, a terrible time in history, but it was reflected, you know, in some really wonderful music.
You know, it's really interesting. You know? It's always a terrible time in history, and it's always a wonderful time in history. We seem to be on this seesaw between negativity and positivity, and it's fascinating. This world fascinates me to no end. I can't... you know, embody enough enthusiasm for being alive.
I wish it was better, more peaceful. You know, everybody got along better, but you know, it is what it is.
It is what it is, and we certainly have to deal with it.
Right. So, but it is reflected very interestingly in the music of the times.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't spoken much at all about images, about photography and the capturing of images. And I know that's something that has been very near and dear to your heart for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just seconds ago you were saying I can't describe or I can't articulate the passion I have for the world. Sometimes you don't need to do that with words.
It's true.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about images and about photography and your collection.
Well, images. Let's see. I recently saw the world's first photograph, which was actually bitumen on a pewter plate taken by Nicéphore Niépce in Paris in 1826. It was closely followed by Louis-Jacquemin Daguerre, who invented the daguerreotype. And when you look at the beginnings of photography and then look at Times Square, it's an incredible arc. Images have changed our lives, you know, absolutely. I've been passionate about photography. I have a book out called Eye to Eye, which is my book of photographs. And one of the first portraits in that book is one I took of my mother when I was 11 years old.
So it started pretty young for you.
Yeah, my father introduced me to the magic of photography when I was 10.
Was that like with a little brownie, or what were you shooting back then?
It was one of those cameras. It was actually an Agfa that he had. He bought it from a friend of his at work. But he used to show me the magic of photography of putting a plain piece of paper into a colorless liquid and saying, wait now. And this image would come floating
magic
onto the paper. It was magic, and I've never, ever forgotten that piece of magic. It's been with me all my life since I was 10 years old. I'm an avid photographer. I carry my camera with me as much as I can. I love images. I love great images. I have we started the world's first digital atelier dealing with photographers in 1989.
Is this Nash Editions?
That's Nash Editions, and it still is continuing to this day.
Yeah, that was very cutting edge. I mean, you guys were cranking out brand new technology.
Not only that, but my first printer that we used at Nash Editions, my friend Mac Holbert and I bastardized into doing what we wanted, is now in the Smithsonian.
I remember I checked into a hotel in San Francisco, and there was one of your books of photography on the table in the lobby area. There.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't realize that you did that.
Yeah, well, you know.
You get around.
Yep. I try and do everything, and I try and do it the best way I can. I mean, you know, with the limited time that we have left. All my life, I've tried to do the best I can. I try to be the best husband and father and friend and artist and musician and sculptor. I try to be the best I can.
I think that is the motto of the troops who came in earlier in the show. Do your best.
Do your best. They had it on their t-shirt. Every single one of those six-year-old kids was proud of their t-shirt that said, do your best.
Well, I want to ask you what's something that that you've become interested in recently, a newfound passion, anything that you've come across recently that's really striking your imagination, firing up your engines.
Painting.
Painting.
Yeah, I've been painting for the last 2.5 years. I've had several shows that were, 90 images that were very successful recently this year.
Like large format?
Yeah, some of them, one of them was, 6 feet by 4 feet.
Like action paintings or landscapes?
I'll tell you what it is.
How would you describe it?
Here's what happened. In 1974, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young went on a tour of stadiums and arenas, basketball arenas. It was the first tour of its kind. Yes, the Beatles had done Shea Stadium, and yes, the Stones had done a couple of big gigs, but no one had ever done a tour of that kind of thing. We did, 36 shows in America in 1974. It was completely crazy. So it was chaotic. It was drug-filled. It was crazy. There was some great music played, but it was nuts. In a way to try and give myself a little peace, I started to draw in this book. And I filled this book with drawings and then put it away and forgot about it. And 2 years ago, I found it. 2.5 years ago, I found it. And because I have this company that we talked about, Nash Editions, about, digital imaging, I scanned them in high res and I printed them up gigantic and painted them.
Oh, wow.
So I'm painting my own photographs. And
You're synthesizing a variety of interests.
Yeah. And one of the things that I love about it is I don't have to ask Crosby what the hell I'm doing, Hey, do you like, I don't have to ask anybody, not even my wife. I just paint for me.
Well, and you can stay inside the lines if you want to.
Or outside the lines.
Or you can go outside the lines.
Actually, you know who helped me was my son Jackson. I told him one day, he saw me painting and I said, I'm kind of embarrassed because I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know whether this color is supposed to go next to that color or I'm supposed to be outside the lines. And he said, I can help you tremendously. I said, how do you do that? He said, you got to watch this documentary on Basquiat, who was a painter in New York, and
A street painter.
Yeah, and what he said basically was, hey, paint like a child. And I thought, I can do that. So I'm having a great time painting. And I'm having great success with it, in terms of people enjoying the work and people buying the work. It's been an amazing couple of years.
What are you discovering about yourself as you're doing that?
That I like to shoot my mouth off. That I like to express my feelings. I'd be crazy if I didn't have an outlet for my feelings and my thoughts. I'd be a basket case.
How is it different when you're making images rather than using words to,
there's no difference.
To emote?
There's no difference.
No difference.
No, there's no difference between writing a song or taking a photograph or carving a piece of marble. There's no difference. It's all the same energy. Which way do you want to point your energy? And I don't get writer's block. Because if I'm not writing, because I'm, I've come upon a wall, I'll go and paint. And if I come upon a wall there, I'll go back to writing or sculpting or collecting or lino cuts or whatever the hell it is I do. It's fabulous world, and I'm very lucky, man.
We have a caller here. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air with our guest this afternoon, Graham Nash.
Yes, mahalo. I have two questions. One, what medium do you paint with, Graham? And then number two, do you have any favorite visual graphic artists?
Oh, absolutely. First of all,
okay, thanks. We'll take it off the air.
I find I love acrylics. I know that you're supposed to be able to get better colors with oils, but I'm too impatient. I want to be able.
I wondered about that.
Yeah, my friend Pierce Brosnan, who also lives here on the island, painted me a painting of a portrait of me for my birthday, and about 2 weeks after I had it, it still wasn't dry. That would drive me crazy. I want to paint and put it away, roll it up in the tube, paint the next one, wait an hour for it to dry, roll it up in the tube. I'm impatient that way.
Well, run out of wall space.
I don't put them on the wall. Galleries put them on the wall. I don't have wall space for my stuff. graphic artist. I love the Impressionists, and I love Egon Schiele. He's one of my favorite painters.
Love Egon Schiele. Great drawer.
He's an incredible artist.
Yeah.
Dead at 21.
Really? I know he was very young when he passed
away.
Dead
at 21. Unbelievable.
Like in 1920 something.
Spanish flu.
Oh, 1918. Ah, okay.
Yeah.
That would do it.
Brilliant, brilliant artist.
That's a shame.
And I love M.C. Escher. I love the way he distorts my mind. I love the way that he looks at the world. I have lots of artists. I love Dion Arbus, who's a photographer of strange images.
Mm-hmm. Very disturbing.
They are
surreal.
Disturbing, but there's lots to be learned when you're disturbed.
Actually, I was going to ask you about that, because there's a story about the song "Teach Your Children Well" that you say originally came from a Dion Arbus photograph. I was wondering if you could tell that story.
Yes, I started to write it when in the last days that I was with the Hollies in late '68, and in 1969 I bought a photograph by Dion Arbus of a boy in Central Park with a hand grenade, and it's a young kid in his shorts, and he's clutching his hand grenade and he's grimacing at the camera, and it's a disturbing image. And I realized that if we weren't teaching our children a better way of dealing with our fellow human beings, that the very future of humanity was at stake. And an aside story, when I sold my collection of photographs at Sotheby's in 1988, this guy comes up to me. There's the evening before the auction, there's a schmooze where people look at the stuff and drink wine and talk and stuff. This kid comes up to me and he goes, "Do you know who I am?"
No way.
And I looked at him and I go, "You know, I don't think so, and I have a really good memory for people and faces and names and stuff, but I don't think we've met." He goes, "Oh, yes, we have." And I'm getting spooked, right? And
sure.
I'm looking at my friend Mac, who's my road manager, kind of protector, and I give him the eye, and he wanders into our circle, and the guy said, "I'm the boy in Central Park with the hand grenade."
Hmm.
And he was like 6'5". And
oh, wow.
I step back and I look at him and I realize that this was the kid.
You could see it in his bones.
Oh, yeah,
in his
absolutely.
Face.
In his face. I never met him, but I was familiar with who he was, right? So I said, "Okay, you got to tell me what the hell happened. Tell me about that moment."
Wow.
He said, "Well, my mother and I would always go to the Central Park on the Sunday, and I would always bring my toy soldiers, and I'd have fake battles, and I'd line them all up, and they would shoot each other and that." He said, "And I did something to upset my mother, and she said, 'No soldiers, we're going to the park, you can bring one thing.' And said, I brought this hand grenade." He said, "And I was thinking about my mother, and I was upset myself with her." He says, "And this woman in black came up to me with a camera around her neck and said, 'Hey, little boy, can I take your picture?' And he said, 'Yeah, you can take my picture.'" And that was the picture.
Hmm. Hmm. Wow, great story. Hey, we have another phone call here. Somebody's been patiently waiting.
Yes.
Aloha, caller. You're on the air.
Thank you. Graham, I know David Crosby has said that he wished maybe more musicians had been able to help out Garcia, you know, the last terrible months of his life. And I just wondered, do you have what's your best Jerry Garcia story? And if you can just take a second and share that with us, if you can think of one.
David was recording an album in Sausalito at the record plant in Northern California. And of course, you know, because we both lived in San Francisco, David lived in Marin, I lived in the city, right above Haight Street. We would interact with all our friends. And I'd written Teach Your Children, and we'd recorded it at Wally Hyder's studio in San Francisco for the Deja Vu record. But there was no solo. And I was talking with Garcia about it over in Sausalito, and he said, I said, "I keep hearing this country thing, you know." And he goes, "You know what? I've just been learning to play the pedal steel. Give me a shot at it." I said, "Jerry, be my guest. Come on." So he brought his pedal steel into the studio at Hyder Studio C in San Francisco. And he put the solo on in Teach Your Children, and the, you know, the beginning and the solo in Teach Your Children.
Awesome.
And then he said, "You know, I kind of screwed that up. Can I do a second take? I said, Jerry, of course you can do a second take. But you know what? I'm not going to use it. You did it perfectly the very first take. And so the intro, that beautiful pedal steel intro and the solo on Teach Your Children was one of the first times that Jerry Garcia ever played pedal steel on record.
Wow. Do you consider him to be the best pedal steel player ever? Or is that
no.
Just
Not at all.
No,
there are many. There are many. He was a great musician, as you well know. But in terms of pedal steel, no. For one of the pedal steels, I mean, you have to go to some of the Nashville guys. You have to go to people that like Ben Keith, who played with Neil for many years. No, Jerry was not the greatest pedal steel player, but he was a great musician.
Right on. All right.
Thank you. Mahalo.
Thank you, Grant. Mahalo.
Hello, everybody. Aloha. I'm Graham Nash. Right now, you're listening to Out of the Box on KKCR with Dave Garau and Jonathan Jay.
All right. Good job.
It's a Giro, isn't it?
Giro, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like Al Giro.
Yep.
With a G, though. Want me to do that again?
Sure.
Sure, you can do okay. It, but we're not going to use it.
I might.
No, go ahead if you want.
He said your name fine. Yeah. You don't care.
Aloha, everybody. This is Graham Nash, and you're listening to Out of the Box on KKCR with David Giroa and Jonathan Jay.
All right. Beautiful. So, Graham, let me ask you a question there. What do you you have a very positive outlook on the world, as even though it's not perfect. What do you see in the future? Do you see humans coming together and
well, I was very things? I was very interested in Stephen Hawking's statement about a year ago when asked how long he thought the human race would last, and he thought for a moment, and then he talks through that talk box, you know, because right. He suffers from MS and he can't speak, and the machine said maybe 1,000 years. Now, I'm 71, right? So, I will be 71. But my point is that 1,000 years is an incredibly short time. It's a blink of an eye in terms of the human race. And to hear Stephen Hawking say that he didn't think that the human race would last 1,000 years was incredibly profound to me. But, having said that, I do have 3 great children. I have 2 boys, Jackson and Will, and my daughter, Niall. Jackson and his girlfriend, Melissa, just made me and Susan grandparents.
Congratulations.
Thank you. With Stella Joy, who is a Stella Joy.
Stella Joy. What a great name.
Yeah. With an R. Stella. S-T-L-L-A-R.
Stella!
Yeah. And so I have to look at the world through the eyes of my kids. And I want it to be the best, and I want them to seek out the best. My kids are incredibly passionate, they're compassionate, they're artistic, they're funny, they're self-assured, they've got their feet on the ground. I could not be prouder. In terms of what I'm doing personally, apart from, you know, my latest passion for painting, this morning, I just finished Stephen Stills' box set, 4 CDs, 50 years of Stephen's music with a 120-page booklet in there with some great, great photographs. I've got plans for another 7 albums, and I have 29 songs that I have not recorded yet. So there's a lot of music coming from this old dog.
So we'll be listening to it for the next 1,000 years.
From your mouth to God's ear, Dave.
I love that. Where does that come from? Yeah.
It's probably a great Jewish saying.
Huh. I had no idea you were Jewish, David.
I'm not.
Oh.
Me neither.
Oh. I guess I'm the only one here then who's half Jewish.
Ah, epistle.
Some Jewish saying. I guess that's what they always say. Some Jewish saying. Okay, let's see. What else is interesting you these days? Say locally. Let's try to bring it local. We touched on a couple of local things
earlier.
Let's
see if we can stay on Kauai.
What's going on in Kauai that interests you or
that you're curious about and want to know more about?
It amazes me that this island does not have more solar. It totally astounds me. I mean, you know, the sun shines, 10 months of the year here. Well, maybe less than that.
It's like, so you have like a solar system
on your house.
Excuse me?
You have a solar system on your house?
Oh, I built my houses with the solar system that
you're
I built
completely
first.
Solar, self-sufficient solar?
No, I still have the grid because, you know, who knows what this technology does. But, yeah, I have solar panels on two of the houses on my property. And I love it. I mean, when I plug into the solar system and I realize that it's kind of free, and not only that, but I'm able to pump it back down the pipe to the utility company, it's an amazing feeling. I know that it might be expensive to start it, and it was expensive when I started. It was $40,000-$50,000, you know, a unit, and I was lucky enough to be able to afford them. But the price is coming down tremendously.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many companies making solar panels now. Why not? I mean, I heard, you know, why do we not have biomass here? Why do we not have, why are we so dependent on gasoline that is so expensive? It's the most expensive gasoline in the entire country.
And the most expensive electricity, too, for that matter.
Yeah.
Well, people have been asking this exact question for decades here on the island.
Right.
And recently, I don't know, maybe it's like the glacier moves slowly, but it's finally moving. KIUC, our local utility cooperative, has finally started signing contracts for large-scale solar farms.
Perfect.
And I think in the next 5 or 6 years or so, they should have about 50% of our daytime consumption will be powered by the sun.
God bless it.
Well, it's fantastic, and I really wish. The only thing I would say that could be better is if they had done that already years ago.
I know, but we can only move from this point forward, right?
Mm. And so what I would also like to see happen in a similar vein is a similar kind of blossoming of the democratic process of how the cooperative is run. I mean, we're blessed here. We have an amazing opportunity that our cooperative is not a for-profit business. It's not their job to make money off of us. Because every single person who's on the grid, you, Dave,
we're all
everyone,
paying for it.
Well, you are all part owners of it.
Indeed.
And so there's a democratic component of that. And I would like to see, in the same way that we have the blossoming of these solar farms, I'd like to see the blossoming of the democratic participation in how our energy needs are met and how we move forward as a cooperative, as a community together.
That would be a great goal to achieve. Absolutely.
Hey, we have a caller.
Hello, Graham. You mentioned a biomass plant. We do have a biomass plant that has already been approved and should be starting to be built pretty soon here down in Poipu.
Fantastic.
And it's there's a farm down there that has been farming Albizia for years now, and that's what it's all about, is biomass with Albizia.
Fantastic. They
look into that. You know,
I will.
There's some controversy behind that also.
What's the controversy?
I can't tell you that.
Well, for one thing, the Albizia is an invasive species, and it's very aggressive. It, you know, when you put a big farm in one place, they pop up every place.
But look at everywhere that produce sugarcane. I mean, why, you know, why can't we start growing biomass in the incredible sugar
right.
cane
Well,
field?
We used to get, 70, 80% of our energy from renewable resources through hydroelectric and...
I think it's only the political will. I think it's the political will that we're not all the way there yet.
Well,
how about this, guys? You know, with a biomass plant here, we can potentially stop using Roundup and the pesticides and herbicides. Cut that stuff, take it to the biomass plant, and turn it into fuel.
Yeah, and this research they're doing on algae that are producing oil is fascinating. I was reading some articles day before yesterday about this new system of trying to create oil from algae.
And then, of course, there's the possibility that we could take our old cane fields and convert them into hemp farms.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
And that would create a tremendous amount of biomass.
It was very interesting what happened in Washington State and Colorado in this last election, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I have friends back there who were overjoyed.
I'm sure they're
They're overjoyed for the right to smoke and then the right to marry
Right. You know, it was basically William Randolph Hearst that made marijuana such a boogaboo.
And that's
because
he was a timber baron.
He was the cotton baron. And hemp threatened that. And so he wanted to, make sure that people understood that hemp was the devil's plant, you know? Amazing. Follow the money. Follow the money, man.
There you go. Hey, Graham, great show. Keep it up. The
The biomass is coming, my friend.
I do you know the name of the company?
I do not.
It's called Green Energy.
Oh, it's called Green Energy.
Yeah, there you go. Jonathan knows.
And I think it's like a 5 or 7 megawatt facility.
Right now.
So that's what, about 10% of our power usage?
Yeah, a little bit less than 10%.
And there's a new solar array going up in Kalaheo, just outside of Kalaheo, too.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. You see, it's all happening, isn't it? We have to remain positive. We have to keep moving forward. This island could be self-sufficient, man. I really believe it.
Yep.
Thank you for your call.
Aloha.
Yeah, as far as the albizia trees go, they're chopping them down and burning them as fast as they can, but they're a vigorous grower.
I know, and they're not so safe either.
No, well, the limbs are very weak, and they have a tendency to crack and fall on whatever below them.
Really?
So it's good to burn them.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, aloha. I love the show. All kinds of interesting stuff going on. Very much appreciate it. And I'm thinking about Buckminster Fuller's comment that for every problem we solve, we create three new ones. Three new ones.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. And actually, if you really look at our capacity for making problems, we are superb at doing it.
We are. The human species is. You're right.
And I think that we make problems in proportion to our intelligence. Right now, we still keep thinking that we need as much energy as we've been using for, you know, in the last century or so.
It's very interesting. I read an article this morning that they believe that human beings, you know, 8,000-10,000 years ago were much smarter than they are now.
Yes. And they were using a tiny amount of what we use. If you look at what we've been doing on this planet, basically, we've been consuming nature and turning it into garbage. I mean, if you looked at what the human race has done for the last 100 years, from 100 miles up, that's the conclusion that you would get.
Yeah, we have to realize one thing though: the Earth itself doesn't care about humanity.
No, of course not.
If every single human being disappeared tomorrow morning, the Earth would keep on spinning, and a new life form would take our place.
Very, very precise. And so let's look at two trends. And there are two major trends going on right now. One, of course, is global warming. And we're approaching a point of the release of methane.
Yeah, I know.
It's called the methane time bomb.
Yes,
trillions
indeed.
Of tons of methane under the ocean floors.
And in Siberia.
Yeah, methane hydrates.
Yep. You know, we have, people say we're approaching the tipping point. My own personal feeling is that we've passed the tipping point. I don't think that humanity is going to be able to deal with the terrible problems that are going to come as a result of global warming.
Right. And that so-called problem, every problem, by the way, is mental. That so-called problem is actually kicking our butts into maturity.
Well, let's hope so, right?
Yeah, my sense is that maturity happens when we get past the ego, which is a juvenile phase, and we get to where we get into sobriety and equanimity and peace of mind.
Well said.
I think that we can actually kick the, we can nip the global warming trend in the bud if we can get to maturity fast enough. Now, that's the big if.
That is a big if.
I would love to hear your comments on this.
It is a big if. And
all right,
you know,
thank you, caller.
Obviously, with the rising of the oceans and the terrible storms that are happening, I mean, it's obvious, you know, when 90% of the scientists out there are saying that global warming is human created, the global warming deniers, when you really reach down and figure out where it's all coming from, they're usually funded by people that have a financial interest in keeping coal and oil all going, and nuclear all going at the same time, because they're making billions of dollars from this. But my question is this: don't people like the Koch brothers have children? Don't they have grandchildren?
And what kind of world do they want?
Don't they know what they're doing to this planet? don't they get it?
You know, my dad used to work for the EPA, and it was his job in the Superfund department to, you know, go to places that were highly toxic and try and figure out how to clean this mess up. And one of the things that he said motivated him was that the people who lived next door to the Superfund site were usually poor people who didn't have...
Of course.
They couldn't afford to move.
Of course. And they have no political power either.
And they have no political power. But there's always some nice place somewhere else where the rich people could go to.
Of course.
And so I think in a way that allows them to be some... If they choose, they can choose to be short-sighted about the consequence of their actions. You ask, you know, if the Koch brothers have kids... Well, maybe they envision a world where they can always go to the nice places.
I know, but they've got to be smart enough to realize that those places are diminishing by the second, you know, and this equality, inequality, between the haves and the have-mores is becoming a big problem.
Caller, you're on the air.
There's a dog on the phone.
Caller, could you please turn your dog down?
Yeah. Oh, it's my neighbor's dog. I'm sorry.
Sure, it's my neighbor's dog.
Always the neighbor's dog.
No, it's not my dog. It's not my dog.
In all reality. Radio down. I just walked inside so you wouldn't have to hear.
That's okay.
And it is my neighbor's dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello. One thing I wanted to mention about the KIU thing.
Sure.
Is that recently, and I didn't get one in my mailbox, but on the, you know, let's use wood, let's use garbage instead of using, petroleum products.
Mm-hmm.
Recently KIUC sent out a newsletter within the last week, something, not everybody got it.
Interesting, I didn't get it. What does it say?
Well, it talks about a plant that will, it's not dealing with solar, it's not dealing with windmills, it's dealing with energy. We are putting together, and this is coming from, I mean, I'm just briefing you from what I have in my memory.
Right.
That some of the... electricity that is available to us will come from this particular source.
Yeah, that's actually what we were talking about a moment ago, caller.
I know
that's
that.
The new biomass plant.
KIUC has a bulletin out in relation to that, like a newsletter, like about a 10-page thing.
Are they embracing the idea?
They're already moving towards it.
Towards the idea.
Towards the idea.
Well, fantastic.
So I just wanted to share that. Yeah, fantastic for me, too, and for you, since we pay the highest utility rates wherever. That I saw this, and I was just looking for it so I could review it to you, but I could not find it.
That's okay, but they're recognizing the energy future and are moving towards
alternative energy prospects.
Fantastic, and is it a positive newsletter?
When I read it, I was amazed.
Fantastic.
Well, okay.
See, the world turns.
The world. Well, hello. Let's see how.
You know what? As soon as they realize they can start making money from this, they'll go for it.
Of course they can.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know they're doing it in different areas of the country, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel very positive about it.
God bless. Don't give up.
God bless. Okay.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Neither are you. Okay, girl. Thank you.
Aloha.
Thanks,
Aloha.
Caller. Well, you always, I think it pays to go out on a positive note.
Indeed.
Because, I mean, we could stand here all day long and talk about doom and gloom, but how do you feel at the end of that kind of conversation?
Yeah, well, like I said, don't give up, you know?
Okay, well, that's all the time we have. Just a couple minutes left in the show, and then we've got Acoustic Luau with Mose.
Now, is there a song that you
Kauai's Smartest Man.
Yeah, it's I think...
Oh, yeah, we're going to go out with the Peter Gabriel song, as you requested. I got it already queued up.
Good.
Are you sure you have it queued
well,
up?
Well, I'm not sure of anything right now. I used to do a music show here, but it's been a while. You know, I sometimes get confused.
I've got to tell you, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Yes,
thank
well,
you.
It's really wonderful to get to know you in a different venue than, you know, the rock star, you know.
One-dimensional
person that, you know, that we hear about. But this has been a wonderful conversation. Hopefully we can have you in again sometime.
You're welcome, Dave.
You know, if you get this one right, Dave, you're going to be one for three. And that you'd be batting .333, which is very impressive.
Yeah, that's actually pretty good for baseball. Yeah.
It's absolutely
good. Dave Ruth.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks a lot. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I think next week Felicia will be on Out of the Box. And
I think
we'll be back in 2 weeks.
All right, so aloha.
We got Christmas coming up. We'll be just after Christmas, I guess.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Oh, yeah, and happy 12-12-12. Oh, and one last thing I want to say is enjoy the Geminide meteor showers tonight.
Tonight.
There's still some left here.
There's still some sparkle in the sky.
All right. Aloha. Going out with Peter Gabriel. What was the name of the song again?
Don't Give Up.
Don't Give Up.
Ah, hui ho.
Thought that I could